The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to the Alternatives podcast. My name's Aditya Chakraborty. With so much of the news being about the housing crisis, whether it's rough sleepers on the streets of London or luxury flats left completely empty in the capital, we thought we'd bring you a solution, a possible solution to the housing crisis. This comes from a place called Granby in Liverpool. Now, you may have heard the name Granby from 2015 when Architects Assemble won a Turner Prize for their work there.
With a timely austerity aesthetic, Assemble and volunteer helpers are making household fittings out of the waste left by dereliction.
There was a lot of coverage at the time about the work that had been done on the houses to regenerate them, bring them back into use, and bring life back to a condemned area. But not very many people at the time talked about the politics of that, which is very important. The residents of Granby had been forced out of their homes for something like 40 years, ever since the Toxteth riots of 1981.
Toxteth, Liverpool 8, once the scene of riots, also suffered from ill-conceived housing policies, say people here. Families were uprooted and their homes demolished.
And what the developers and the council wanted to do was flatten the rest of the homes and build new ones in their place. Now, the woman you're about to meet, Hazel Tilley, was part of the fight back against that. She's a remarkable woman. If you go into her terrace house in the middle of Granby, she's always very keen to give you lots of food. And if you go into the front room, you find loads and loads of LPs everywhere and these stadium level speakers. Now, apart from all of that, why is Hazel interesting? Because she effectively broke the land market. And in Britain, you don't get any market more powerful than land. Listen to the way that she explains how that process worked by setting up this community land trust. Hazel Tilley.
Hello.
Hazel.
Yeah.
It's Aditya.
Oh, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right.
For the rest of this conversation, we'll be talking about Granby, where you live. So
yes,
just tell
yes.
anyone who's never been there what Granby's like.
It's wonderful. It's a Granby itself is a small part of Toxteth, which is a big part of Liverpool. But Granby is a main street, and it forms part of a triangle with other streets radiating off it. So the very bottom street is quite short, and the top street is very long, and it's multicultural. We're within stone's throw of a mosque.
Now, you've described what sounds like an excellent place, and it is an excellent place because it's really well located. You're about, what, half an hour's walk out city centre?
That's right, yeah.
You're very near all the parks.
Yep.
Wide Victorian streets, lots of lovely red bricks.
Yep.
And yet, the area you're describing has had, for decades, a terrible reputation.
Yep.
Especially the area, the wide area known as Toxteth.
And Granby Street in particular, yeah.
Right, so tell me about the reputation it's had.
It was really deemed to be a troublesome area. We've got a black community that goes back generations, so that we've got, you know, black people who are very Scouse. We've got Chinese people who are Liverpoolian. It's just a fantastically colourful, culturally, racially rich area where people seem to rub along in a nice way. But, you know, there's a lot of discrimination around. I think that Liverpool has actually shown itself to be a racist city, and there's a reputation that is built on people that doesn't belong to them. And the area became houses of multiple occupation, usually private landlords, you know, letting a room out to a family. And it became a cheap place to live, and then it became run down, and the mythology has hung about. And I remember the signs that said no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, you know, that were put up in the windows of rental houses around the area. And there's no place for that.
What you're basically describing there is a kind of local economy that was always hobbled by racial discrimination and class discrimination.
Yes, I think so,
and then,
yeah.
And then local housing, which never got the investment that it deserved. So these handsome Victorian red bricks never really were properly maintained. And then you had a kind of local population that knew they were being treated unfairly and they were resentful. And this all came to a head in 1981. Tell me what happened then.
Well, that's when we had what the media called the riots, and we know here as the uprisings.
To the people who live here, this is Liverpool 8. To the rest of us, it's Toxteth. The name alone evokes images of conflict in the minds of people living outside this ghetto. This is the story of the people.
It was against general discrimination, a lack of jobs if you were a person of colour or you had an address in Liverpool 8. Police, really, really nasty, negative policing. Disinvestment in the area. And, you know, eventually people backed into a corner will stand up and fight. And that then brought with it a further degeneration of the area where the council really bollarded in. They ghettoised Granby and started to decant people at various government initiatives that paid councils to demolish. Housing Market Renewal Initiative brought about demolition.
So first they pinned you in and then they started to empty out the streets, right? And you were living there at the time. And
yeah.
And so houses all around you were getting what's known as tinned up.
That's right.
Tell us about that. What's that like to live through?
It was brutal. I don't blame people for leaving because it started really with the housing associations not investing, so not managing repairs and things. It was 26 years ago when the council decided they were going to mow us and knock us all down and empty out. And housing associations offered people money to move. A lot of people were absolutely adamant they were going to stay in the area, so houses that had been demolished, there was some private housing built and some housing association stuff built. And this has always been a mixed economy of housing, so we were pleased to see that mix, you know, remaining. But people made it clear that they wanted to stay in the area.
All right, but you've talked in the kind of the collective. I want to know what it's like for you as a resident to see all your neighbours go and everywhere around you, all the houses get tinned up.
It was awful. The council forgot to clean our streets. They forgot to fix the street lights. They forgot to empty our bins. The postman for a while was wondering whether the streets were empty, but God loved the post people. They carried on delivering. It's terrace streets, and it had an impact that you don't, you know, you start to neglect your own house because it's hard to put money into something if you don't know it's going to be demolished, and you have an empty house each side. And then the council, in their wisdom, came and stripped the lead off the empty houses, so that off the roofs off the empty houses, and they said that so it wouldn't be stolen. We became overrun with rats and feral cats. And they didn't cancel each other out. And, you know, you lost friends, you lost people that you'd lived next door to, that you'd shared your life with, you know, and they moved to other streets.
Did you never think about moving, Hazel?
I couldn't afford to move. The council were offering peanuts, and I'd saved up, and I'd bought this house, and I was paying a mortgage. I was 35 when I bought my own house. You know, and I bought it in an area that I love, with people that I respect and admire. And, you know, I didn't want to move and I didn't want to see the houses come down because I'd seen it. I'd seen these streets full of family and life and arguments and fighting and parties and making up and borrowing a cup of sugar. I'd seen the kids playing in the streets and giving them juice and shouted at them and done the things that people do, you know, and we knew what it could be like.
All right, that's the kind of the scene setting. And then something starts to happen around the turn of the millennium. In the early 2000s, your neighbour, Eleanor, goes out and starts some gardening. Tell me about that.
Well, she started sweeping up. And we used to see each other. But she broke phone numbers down and put them through our doors. And it was like, where to report fly tipping, where to report this, where to report that. And people started to phone the council and, you know, the security firms that were supposed to be looking after the empty houses and, you know, phoning to make sure our refuse was collected and complaining when streetlights weren't on and, you know, and cleaning up and deciding that we'd lived with rubbish and cat poo for long enough and we needed to clean out the empty houses behind the railings and do something about it and paint paint things because it was drab and dark and dreary. And so Eleanor starts, and then Carol and Maria, who lived in the street, well, Carol still lives in the street, Maria passed away at Christmas, but they came out with brooms and started planting things, and then we all started doing it. And then the kids coming home from school wanted to do it. And people who hadn't walked down the street started to walk down the street to see what we were doing.
So this is an old story in a British context, because in the old cliche goes, an English man's house is his castle, but you're never really meant to touch your next door neighbour's house. But here you were suddenly turning the entire street into something that you were going to look after. Everyone's houses you were looking after now.
Yeah, the streets are our garden. If you want to build community, it doesn't start with a house. It starts with people. And if you want people to meet each other, then you've got to make a nice place for them to walk through, to sit in, to talk to each other.
And when, so you've told me about how the council was going through all these various attempts to transform your neighbourhood, i.e. knock it down and start again.
Yeah.
When did the turn come, do you think?
The turn came with, unfortunately, the turn came when the Labour government left and the Tories came in. And I say that because I'm left-wing and socialist, or I like to, I'm working that way. Really, it was unfortunate, but the Conservative government in and came in and said this housing market renewal initiative and the Pathfinder is, it, you know, it's not good. It's led to wholesale destruction.
Just to be clear, the Pathfinder initiative you're talking about was a scheme dreamt up by Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott, which is basically saying there are too many empty homes. What we should do is knock them down and that will bring the price up of the other homes. Except in your case, what it would have done would mean kicking you out of your own home and people like Eleanor too, right?
Yeah, in my case, but across Liverpool it happened, across Birmingham it happened, across every city in the country it happened. You know, because there was financial initiatives for local councils to do this.
They were basically being incentivised to treat your lives like a brownfield site, right?
Yeah.
OK, so the Pathfinder initiative, the money for that is taken away by David Cameron.
Yeah.
For his own reasons, because he wants to do spending cuts. But it works out nicely for you. You've suddenly got an opportunity. And then you do this thing where you incorporate yourselves as a community land trust.
Right. The CLT allowed us to buy 10 houses at £1 each from the council and to do them up economically for sale and for rent. And we're able to let those houses at a social rent and to sell the houses at an affordable rate. And we've put a covenant on the houses for sale to keep it affordable forever.
But the idea is that you're suddenly saying, look, we're a community and we want to own this land together, not as individuals.
Yeah, we want to make it work for the future. And for the, it's like creating a heritage for the future and, you know, using what the heritage that we've got from the past. I see a community land trust as being a creative thing for the people who live and visit and work within a particular area.
Now, the thing about a community land trust or a CLT is they're fairly recent in this country. They've only been knocking around for 20-odd years.
That's right, yeah.
They were only enshrined into law in 2008, and you were one of the first ever urban community land trusts.
Yeah, we were.
So what's your thinking there? Normally, it's the sort of thing done by villagers in Cornwall. Why are you suddenly bringing it into inner-city Liverpool?
Because it's important. This was a community, and it was being destroyed. And what we needed as a community to rebuild it was places for people to live. And the places were there. They were just being left to rot. And there was no money for the council to do it up. So if we formed a community land trust, we might be able to raise some money if we could get the council to share the houses with us.
And did you manage to raise some money?
Yeah. There was a young woman called Zanzi, and she was another key figure in helping us at the beginning. And she was working for a millionaire who wanted to invest in a social enterprise. And you know, we were on the media, we had a website going, and she came and visited us and said, you know, there's somebody who'd like, you know, I need some more information, but there's somebody who'd like to help you financially. And she worked with us and introduced us to Assemble, the architects, who designed the renovation work on our houses and designed beautiful things to go in them and, you know, costed it up to what was would make it reasonable for sale and let. And the millionaire lent us £500,000.
So the secret millionaire lent you £500,000?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Astonishing. Wonderful. Incredible. It was unbelievable. It was a great thing to do because we were able to match fund.
How do you mean match fund?
We were able to get grants that match what he'd lent us.
So you have the CLT, you've started to get more funding, you started to get some fund, quite a lot of funding suddenly go your way, and you've started to get some political support because there's this Deputy Mayor of Liverpool, Anne O'Byrne.
Yeah, oh, she's been great. Anne O'Byrne's been helpful all the way through. She's been a really, really positive councillor, yeah.
And this is despite the fact your own local councillors were telling you that your area should be knocked down.
Yeah.
But there she is saying actually she wants to back you. So you've got this outside support, and then you've got this group of architects called Assemble, who are up from London.
Yeah.
Assemble has helped in refurbishing 10 derelict houses on Cairn Street, and have even proposed turning one ruined house into a glass roof winter garden.
We'll put another doorknob in here, and we, you know, put leaves in here. Because when the actual burning process takes place, you get these wonderful patterns of the veins of the leaf on, really? on the ceramic surface, which is quite beautiful.
Tell me what it's like working with them and what that led to.
They're just great. They just listened to what we had to say. It was a group of young men and women, and they listened to us. And they were green. They were clever enough to know what they were doing, but young enough and green enough to not recognise what you couldn't do. So they did it. They came up with solutions to the impossible. They incorporated our ideas. They listened to what it was like to hear a house being ripped apart. So their strip out was gentle.
Give me an example of how they made the impossible possible.
They just came up with so many different ideas and plans, from the absolutely beautiful but incredibly expensive, so that we'd never be able to rent that out at a social price, to just very gentle stuff, saying, well, you know, this has gone, but look at the roof beams that are exposed. How can we keep them exposed and make the house nice? You know, we won't, if there's a dividing wall, we'll keep it. We won't knock it down and make them all look the same. So all of our houses are slightly different because each house is true to its own character and what was left standing.
So what they basically did was they took demolished house bricks.
Yeah.
And reconstitute them into fireplaces, which you can see now in the houses that Granby CLT owns.
Yeah, and kitchen work surfaces, and they made individual tiles. And so every house, and the doorknobs, which were, you know, porcelain, they made lovely porcelain little doorknobs and then wrapped them in odd things and threw them in a barbecue and did that with children on Saturday morning on a market day. And every single little doorknob is different. Every tile is different. Every fireplace is different. They made kitchen work surfaces out of Granby rock, which are just beautiful.
And all this work led to the Turner Prize in 2015.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was amazing. That was just like, it can't be real. I knew when I looked at the other entrance, I knew we would win. I just knew it.
Why?
Because the whole concept of these beautiful handmade things that were made in the street, in backyards, that came out of people's heads, that were collective and were for collective pleasure, was just such a wonderful idea. And it's art. To me, it's art in its finest form.
Because you know there was this debate at the time about how can housing be art?
Well, because it's... You know, if art represents life, then what represents life more than where you live? You know, from a cardboard box in the street to Buckingham Palace. You know, it says everything.
So how many houses have you got now?
11 and the Winter Garden.
And the Winter Garden. And yeah. You bought them for what, a quid each off the council?
Yeah.
And then you've had to invest all the money that you raised to try and do them up?
Yeah.
And how many houses have you completed now?
Eight.
And just tell listeners, what are you doing? Because you've got a particular approach to letting and to the sale of these houses, haven't you?
Yeah. we had to sell five of them.
Just to fund all the other work, right?
Well, to repay the millionaire, because it was a loan, and it was a fantastic loan, and, you know, I can't say thank you enough to this gentleman, because it was a fantastic thing that he did. You know, what we wanted to put a covenant on. Now, we first looked at shared ownership, and then there was some, we had some really negative things that came about shared ownership, you know, the dangerous things to look out for. And East London Community Land Trust put a covenant on their properties, and so we looked at their model, and it wasn't eventually the model that we picked. But what we did was put a covenant on the ground that the houses stand on, and the covenant keeps the houses within the income value, the median income of the area, in perpetuity, so it keeps the houses permanently affordable.
And the people who've actually bought houses can never, just to clarify this, the people who've actually bought houses can never sell them on for market rates. They have to sell them on for a rate that's tied, for a price that's tied to what people are actually earning.
Yes, yeah, within this area, yeah, and it's a median rate, so that it's not skewed by one person earning a hell of a lot and 10 people earning not very much. So that's why we've gone for the median and not the mean average.
Put this story together for me. You've got a story of you taking on both the council and developers who want to knock you down effectively and move you out. And then you incorporate yourself into this different organisation and you raise your own money and you bring in people who are experts on various things, whether it's housing, whether it's law, whether it's city politics, whatever. And then you end up with these houses that you're running on a very different regime to the way the market normally works.
Well, I hope so. And that's what we strive to do, yeah.
What's the politics of all of that?
It's politics of people. It's politics of poverty and giving people an opportunity. Not just poverty of money, poverty of experience, poverty of environment. You know, it's about people. It's about populating people. It's about people having homes. I'd say it was socialist.
You know, when I came to visit you, Hazel, and I saw what you did, it struck me that what you'd effectively done was taken the land that you were living on out of the market, and you'd taken yourselves from being kind of a commodity to be traded at will to the community.
Yeah, we're not a commodity. We're people. And what's more, we're voters. And taxpayers, and council taxpayers, you know, and we work. And the unfortunate thing that is that when you look at the gross domestic product of this country, the hours that people give voluntarily isn't counted. The good deeds that people do isn't counted. And I would like to know what makes it so valueless.
Can I ask you one last thing? Most of the names that have come up in our conversation have been women, and most of the people associated with Granby, like the core group associated with Granby, whether it's you, Eleanor, Teresa, Maria, Carol, most these names are women's names. Why is it that it's women who are associated with Granby? Why is it women are so important to the story of Granby?
There's a lot of women lived here. And I think that women do things. I think they talk to each other and then they do things. Yeah, I just think, and I think that Liverpool basically is quite matriarchal, and I think that the women take things in hand and do stuff. And that's what we did. I think women notice what happens to other people's children. I can't imagine what it must be like to have been growing up in this area and to be taken through streets that were empty and dirty and dank with fly-tipped rubbish on the way to school every day. How do you invest in your future if you can't invest in the children now?
What would the children growing up now in Granby see as they go to school?
Well, I hope that they see plants and people and little places to sit and chat on the way home and other kids playing in the streets and lots of different friendly smiling faces or not so smiling faces, people going about their bother. That's what I hope kids see. I hope they see that this is a place where you can make friends and you're safe and you can knock on doors. because you know who lives there.
Hazel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for giving us the opportunity.
My thanks to Hazel Tilley. What she didn't mention is that although her CLT only owns 11 homes, actually they've managed to change the face of all four streets, because the housing associations, who own many of the other homes on that area, are sticking to pretty much the same lettings policy. So they're only letting out to people who can demonstrate a commitment or connection to the locality. And most of those homes are being let out at social rent. It's a really remarkable story of how just a few people owning a few homes can change the face of an entire area. That's it from me. If you want to keep in touch, I'm at alternatives@theguardian.com. The producers of the Alternatives podcast are Lily Ames and Phil Maynard. See you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.